That's right. You know, no government body or any other group will vote for a bailout for pepper spray because they're always on a shoestring budget, and they're a grassroots media maker and progressive voice for all of us. So definitely check out their table when you're out there. Before I begin with some opening remarks and introducing the panelists, I believe Jim Page is here and wants to do a song or two to open it up and get the energy moving. Is that right, Jim? Are you out there? Or maybe not. Or maybe not. Okay, we can just go right into the panel. If anyone sees Jim or he shows up, please let me know. So I'm going to try to keep this brief because I want to make this into more of a discussion where our panelists get to speak and then everyone gets to talk a little bit about the issues presented in the movie and prevalent issues that have come out since the RNC and DNC. But first, I'm going to talk a little bit why it's important to have independent voices in the media. And to begin, or to preface this short statement, I want to go rewind back to November 3rd, 1969. Nixon had just completed this speech where he was assuring the American public that he would begin this process of Vietnamization. Prior to this, he had this secret plan to end the war. You'll find a lot of parallels between then and now, in which the United States is mired in a war that it shouldn't have been in the first place. Tons of money lost in that war, and an economy also in the pits. And a president who was a crook. And in this speech, he talked about the silent majority. He claimed that the folks out on the streets protesting the war, trying to hold our elected representatives accountable, they were actually some fringe group. They weren't the real majority in the United States. These people were just a loud, small group of people. Now, I think that I can't really speak to that time. I think that actually the people at that time were actually the majority out on the streets. They were a loud majority. And that the people who are here now protesting the RNC and the DNC, who are out on the streets, they're actually a majority, and they're a loud majority, and they're not just a majority, they're a majority that's mad as hell and not going to take it anymore. And they're not only that majority, but they're a majority that you don't normally see on the airwaves. You turn on your CNN, you turn on your regular cable 24-hour news, or you turn on your evening news, you don't see the protesters. You don't see this majority that aren't fringe, disaffected students or youths. These are grandparents. These are families. These are kids in college. These are former veterans. These are regular folks who take it upon themselves to go out into the streets and to tell the world and their elected representatives what they feel about what's going on in this country. And if you expand those borders globally, you'll find that this is a majority globally, I think. And so it's up to us to shed this lens on this majority that don't often get the lens put on them. They don't often have this access to the broadcast airwaves. They don't often have access to any kind of media making outlet. And so it's up to regular citizens like yourselves, community journalists, folks with a tape recorder or a pen and a paper, to let the world know that there are people that are part of this global majority that want to stand in solidarity with the global South, with people who are also against war and militarization, to let them know that there is unity within the United States and beyond. And so as news and public affairs director at KBCS, I have people coming in every week who want to get empowered and to want to do this type of journalism and want to bring to light the voices in their community that you don't normally hear. And it is with that that I introduce the set of panelists that are coming up, who are all in their own way part of the mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore, majority that is on the streets and organizing against things like the Republican National Convention and the Democratic National Convention. So without further ado, please come up to the stage when I call your name and introduce you. First, I want to introduce Shimako Noble. Shimako is President and Executive Director of Hip Hop Congress, a member of the Poor People's Economic and Human Rights Campaign, and performing artist. He helped organize the protests in Minneapolis-St. Paul. Shimako is currently based in San Jose. Shimako, welcome. Next, I want to introduce Larry Hildes. He's a litigation director for the National Lawyers Guild Center for Democratic Communication. In recent years, he has represented war resistors, radio pirates, anti-war protesters, and my colleagues. Last month, he was in Twin Cities helping arrestees. Excuse me. Larry is based in Bellingham. Larry, welcome. Thank you. Next, I want to introduce a friend of mine. Susan Gleason is a co-founder and co-director of Reclaim the Media. She is also outreach director for Yes Magazine on Bainbridge Island. Susan attended the Democratic National Convention in Denver, and we're happy to report that she's safe and sound here in Seattle. Susan, welcome. And last but not least, I'd like to introduce Doug Honig, Communications Director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Washington State. The ACLU is the strongest national organization dedicated to protecting the fundamental civil liberties of freedom of speech, freedom to assemble, and freedom of the press. Welcome, Doug. There you are.
Wow, good to see you.
And so we're going to begin the panel with 5 minutes of remarks also from each of you. And let's start in the order that you were introduced. Shimako, go ahead.
Good afternoon, everybody, and thank you for coming out. I just have to point out, to me this is hilarious, right? But so I didn't know I was in that movie. interestingly enough, I'm wearing the same exact shirt that I was wearing in the movie. So that's kind of crazy. It's crazy, right? Like, I'm tripping out right now. I just wanted to talk a little bit about what my general experience at the RNC was like, and then I guess a little kind of perspective on why it's important, as requested by Mr. Lawson. So I arrived about a week in advance Thursday, and as they noted, I'm a part of an organization called PPERC. I also work with another organization called Hip Hop Congress, the intersection being that, believe it or not, artists often have a lot of poor people issues. I basically got off the plane and immediately found myself inside of like a HUD takeover, because Sherry had invited one of the, directors to come to our Truth Commission. They accepted, then reneged. So I started my time in the RNC basically at a sit-in at HUD. That was my first opportunity to sort of see what was going to happen with the media on two folds. One, there was a gentleman there with a camera. The cops actively pushed him, like physically pushed him into the elevator and would not allow him to cover the story. And then also they arrested three people, and the camera was set up. There were four different exits, and the camera was set up at an exit where they brought out the male. There were three people arrested. Two of them were women, one of them a male. And they took the women out another entrance. And then they sent a PR guy to come and talk to us in the media while they were sneaking him out the back. So you saw the Bushville up there. That was our second day, my second day. And it was like a one-day thing set up at Harriet's Island across from the Excel Center at the RNC. And it was about 30, 35 people, men, women, children, elders from all over the country, Chicago, Kentucky, New Jersey, New York, Philadelphia, California. And you know, it's there's a, the phrase I learned while I was out there, Minnesota nice. And so the police, they were Minnesota nice. And you know, you saw one, there were basically four of those. You saw the conversation with Sherry and the police. There were about four of those throughout the day. And every day, or every conversation, there were like more police officers come that would come into the conversation. And then they sent like a negotiator, and they were smiling, they're like smiling the whole time. And so we set up in the afternoon around like 11 or 12. They gave us a deadline of about 11. And at 11, they basically flanked, because we were kind of sort of on the bank of the Mississippi. So they sort of flanked us on three or four sides. I don't know how they did it on four sides. We had one side, but I don't know how they did it. So they sort of flanked us on like three or four different sides with lines of like 15 to 20 officers. So there was easily visible somewhere between, I'd say, 60 to 70 officers. And they basically, you know, forced us off the property. The thing that got me, though, was that when we were leaving, and there were three people or two people arrested that night. It was Sherry and a gentleman named Tim Dallin. When we were leaving, you guys saw that bridge. There was like that little bridge that people were walking in the day when we were setting up the Bushville. As we were leaving, they had like snipers posted on that bridge. So, and it's dark, so you can't really see them. And of course, you know, we don't know what the snipers could see either. I mean, they have sights or whatever, but, and I mean, they're like kids out there. So had something gone on, just know that there are snipers and bridges that, you know, we have the order. And there's actually another set of about 40 to 50 police officers sort of hidden, tucked away in the corner. So that was day two. And then there was a weekend, and over the weekend, of course, they mentioned in the movie that the raid started. And it was very rapid. It's like the raid started on, I think, like a Friday or Saturday night. It was Friday night? Yeah. Thank you. The raid started on Friday night, and we were actually passing out flyers for an event, and the information spread quickly, so we heard it from somebody on the street. And then, like, by morning, there had been, like, two or three more, and then by the afternoon, and, like, the total had been, was, like, seven. And that was just, like, in a day's period. And so, kind of in that same vein, we had set up a second Bushville in the projects of St. Paul, which they weren't as eager to get us out of, interestingly enough. But what they did do is they would send police officers at night, and they would have them, they'd have them sort of drive by with their sirens on back and forth and flash their lights at people while they were sleeping and have dogs barking at people. It's unnecessary. And of course, during our actual, especially looking at the video, like, you know, the time you're so in the moment, you don't really think about it. The video, it is I don't know how we actually made it out of the march without anything happening. Because, I mean, something happened immediately following, like 5 to 10 minutes following the march's ending. It happened. But I mean, like, I actually had, like, in both instances, I was about 5 or 10 minutes out from the insanity, like on the day of the anti-war march. I think I left about 5 minutes before everything went on, and then our march ended. I think I left about 5 minutes before everything went on. Literally walked up a hill, and it was absolute chaos. And the police were not letting people out in both instances. They would block entire sections of motion and sort of corner people in to sort of bring down to create the possibility or increase the possibility of doing something. They shut down. They kept our power off. During the rally before our march, had surrounded our park, and actually the Justice Department came and wanted to protect us from the police, which is weird because they weren't actually talking to the police, which we're still trying to kind of figure out. Of course, they were just arresting people en masse. I mean, I don't even know if they were paying attention at one point. They saw you. You looked like you looked like a human being without a Batman uniform on, and you were getting arrested. And you know, it's important to keep in mind that they spent, especially with what's happening now, the economy, the $700 billion bailout, they spent $50 million on that. Like, there was a $50 million like injection of funds into the security of that event, which I think people probably would like to, like, now that's even more relevant than before. And just for note, the whole purpose of our march was to keep the issues of, you know, another aspect of the real silent majority, poor people in this country, a number that's increasing every day, you know, to keep their issues on the table. And, of course, to keep the focus on human rights like the right to housing, the right to health care, and the right to an education, which given what's happening right now with the housing market, the economy, and the banking system, seems extremely relevant. I think one of the things that's really important to keep in mind, our march, actually, the same thing that happened there with like the Rage Against the Machine, the DNC, happened at our march, where there was a concert going on that they had actually shut down. And so they ended up having, like, that crowd ended up joining the march. A lot of that never made it into the mainstream national media. I mean, it was a lot of independent media, but it's almost as if they just don't want people to know that there are people that are thinking, experiencing, and going through the same things that they're going through around the country. And if, you know, the first response to the bailout was very indicative, right? It was like people were calling, everybody was calling. Like, people were voting against that 10 to 1. Wouldn't it have been great if those people knew, were more aware of the fact that this movement has been here, is going, is growing, and will continue to grow? But, of course, they put a lot of effort both into the construction of the media and, of course, in the security of that event to make sure that that doesn't happen. So I guess with that, I'll pass. If anybody has any questions, more than happy. Thank you for your time.
I want to make a slight correction to the introduction. We were actually in both Denver and St. Paul, and that's actually kind of important to what I want to describe to you in a minute. It was both the most exhilarating and the most terrifying experience I think we've ever had. And I was at, we were at the RNC in New York in 04, and I was at the RNC in 96 in San Diego, and we did the criminal cases that followed the DNC in Chicago in 96. And this was a major escalation. And Denver was bad. They did a night where they arrested journalists, legal observers like us. We managed to stay out of the cordon, and a lot of people who just wanted to march. And it got real nasty and real scary. St. Paul was, I think, the worst we've ever seen. And it started early. The raid started a week before, when they raided Glassbead and Eyewitness. And you saw the bus for mobile broadcast news. We rode the bus for mobile broadcast news from Denver to St. Paul because they were scared to death of getting raided, and we went along as legal support in case. And we found out when we got on the bus that it can't go over 55 miles an hour and runs on unused vegetable oil. So we're crawling down I-80 at 55 miles an hour through every inch of Nebraska. And as we're doing it, text messages start flying in. They've raided the Food Not Bombs house. They've raided the Poor People's Campaign. They've raided the Legal Collective. They've raided Eyewitness Video a second time. They've raided these houses in South Minneapolis. And it keeps getting worse and worse. And we're sitting there at 55 damn miles an hour. Look, there goes a caravan of the FBI. We know where they're going. They know where we're going. Look, there goes the National Guard. They're going to get there 16 hours before we do. But we got to St. Paul. And as we're coming in, we stopped at a truck stop in West Des Moines so they could shift the oil tanks on the bus to get us the rest of the way. And we're sitting in this Flying J having this miserable buffet with Fox News on, and we're all looking at each other. We don't have to go to St. Paul. We could go on to Winnipeg and ask for asylum. We don't really want to do this. There's that too. But we did. We went on. And sure enough, Tuesday, I was really jealous getting to hear about the Poor People's March. We saw about 15 minutes of it, because we got called off the Poor People's March because, sure enough, they were trying to raid the bus of mobile broadcast news in a parking lot behind a cafe where Code Pink was having a fundraiser. And we get there, and there's this cop trying to kick in the door of the bus. And I walked up to her and said, "What the hell are you doing?" Legal observer hat, legal observer shirt. "We're looking for dead bodies." It's a TV studio. There's no dead bodies in there. Maybe dead footage, but no dead bodies. Get lost. They left. We go to the march. 20 minutes later, we get the second call. There's eight cop cars at Mobile Broadcast News and the Rude Mechanical Orchestra, which is in the next bus. And they take off, and we're left with Mobile Broadcast News. And you may have seen a picture of a cop on the trunk of a car cruising by, shining his flashlight in his video camera. It's my first photographic credit. I took that picture. And again, down the length of the bus, videotaping in. And again, officer, what the hell are you doing? And you can see these two nasty-looking cops in front of him. They got a lot closer than I would have liked. We sat there for another hour and a half or 2 hours while they tried to wait us out until they finally gave up. And nobody ever raided Mobile Broadcast News. It was one of the few victories over the raids we had. But the attacks on the media were worse than anything I have ever seen in 13 years as a lawyer and many years as an activist before that. It was systematic. And for once, it was not just indie media. We represent indie media all the time. It was ABC and CNN and the St. Paul Pioneer Press and the Denver Post. And once Thursday night in St. Paul, they actually got Fox News. The only time I've ever supported a reporter getting arrested. After 2 weeks of watching people try to get Fox to get lost, the cops finally did it for us. But the systematic raids after raids after raids after raids was a major ratcheting up. And I know Doug Honig's going to talk about some of the history and where this came from. But they really turned the screws. And it was not just the Republicans. It was the Democrats. They wanted no media coverage of protests. They wanted this image of total unity in support of their candidate. And they didn't get it. But they sure tried in both places. But I am so proud that we were able to be there and to get people out of jail and go into the jails when we needed to and to keep people able to be out on the street and as safe as possible. I got hit with a concussion grenade and tear gas on Monday when right about the time Amy got arrested, she was a few blocks away from where I was following this group that had been marching through the streets, creating roving blockades, complete with a marching band and a halftime show. And it was an amazing event. But we all came out of it, I think, feeling a lot less safe than maybe we went in. And that's going to be up to us to take that back. I mean, there's a running joke in our office. Every time we hear somebody on videotape or live chanting, "Whose streets? Our streets," we look around because somebody's going to get arrested. So that's usually when that chant comes out. But they are. They are our streets. They are our cities. And those damn conventions are there because we're willing to allow them to be. And what St. Paul did show and what Denver did show is sometimes we're not willing to allow them to be, and that's real important. As a lawyer, it was a privilege to be in both of these places and supporting these protests, because this is going to determine where this country goes, whether we go further down the very scary road we're on now, or we pull it back and we take it back, or we take it because we've never really had it before. Would be good. Okay, I'm gonna pass the microphone on to Susan Gleason.
It's great to hear these stories, these direct report backs from Denver and from Minneapolis. Sure, sorry about that. I was just St. Paul, thank you.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I appreciate that. And also to see this amazing footage, I recognize some folks in the audience who were also at yesterday's screening of Chicago 10. It was a free screening as part of the Independent Lens Community Cinema effort, and that'll be airing on PBS, and that's worth seeing. There's some amazing parallels between the the brutality, the repression in 1968 at the Democratic nominating convention, and what we saw today. Only the brutality stepped up, the repression stepped up, the tactics have stepped up, and it's just horrifying. I wasn't in St. Paul. I was in Denver, not so much as an activist. I was really there doing outreach on behalf of Yes Magazine, where I work, and just saw some of the street protests, the IVAW protests there, and a healthcare not warfare protest. And so a lot of this is new to me. I was watching the coverage of what was happening in St. Paul from here, from Seattle, as I could in between work and other things. So I really appreciate what role independent media played in covering this. Seeing the kind of coverage that was going at sometimes minute by minute on social media tools like Twitter, if folks are familiar with that, microblogging. Folks from the Cold Snap Legal Collective that were mentioned in the film, and even folks who weren't there in St. Paul but were acting as kind of a dispatch through this online media tool were relaying information as quickly as they could about what was happening on the streets. And then the Uptake had some cameras there that would allow for direct upload of the video that they were taking on the streets right to the web. So that footage was live with a chat function right next to it. That was on a website called QIK, or that was the mechanism that they used. But so much independent coverage. The Submedia, Pepper Spray, Laura Flanders was there with Grit TV. Of course, Democracy Now! Was covering it. Indie Media, bloggers, you know, a whole slew of independent and community coverage. And yet, a lot of that coverage still wasn't seen by so many people. So many people back here in Seattle and elsewhere across the country didn't see what was happening. And we've got to keep fighting for our independent media, supporting our independent media clearly, and creating spaces for more independent community media to be available. I think that the film says it exactly right, which is the media are our ears and eyes for the public. In these moments of crisis, in moments of conflict, in moments of violence, war, protests, the people have a right to know that there's dissent on the streets, just like Shimako was saying. What if the people had known what kind of movement is growing, whether it's at those conventions or at the US Social Forum last year or other convergences, where still so many people don't know that there are movements building. Our ears and eyes, and it, not just for the sake of our knowing, but actually for our sake of getting the story as it was, because also as it was said in the film, if the media is shut down, then the storytelling, the truth-telling is shut down, and who controls the frame? Who controls the actual telling of the story that happened? It's the corporate media, and the NPR, who are avoiding the true stories at hand. So this is a struggle that continues, and I'm gonna say just to add to what happened, what we didn't see in the film is there was a lot of additional preemptive organizing by the city to shut down the media. They had tried to set up an embed program where reporters that agreed to be embedded in some certain kind of parameter going with these mobile field units of the police, that they would not be arrested. And notices were handed out to other media that, you know, the gloves are off if you haven't signed on to this. And what many people heard was, you know, the very cynical move of the city of taking out that $10 million insurance policy to indemnify themselves against any lawsuits that would come their way afterwards. That you may have also heard about training programs to basically coach the police that there'll be many activists out there who are posing as medics and posing as legal observers and posing as media. So be wary, don't trust them if that's what people say they are. And you know, even Amy Goodman and her producers themselves had their credentials ripped off when they said, we're with the media. And they just ripped the credentials off, what a Secret Service agent did. So these are really troubling times. It just seems to get all the more so regarding this aspect of being able to round up the media and arrest them and block the story from getting out, disrupt their whole process. You know, even if the charges for many of them got dropped later, it totally disrupted the work that they were setting out to do and disrupted really critical stories coming to us. I'm going to pass it over to Doug at ACLU. Sure, thanks.
I wasn't in Denver or St. Paul, and I'm not a lawyer, but I'm the communications director for the ACLU for quite a few years, and I talk to lawyers. And also, I'm very interested in history, so I'd like to talk a little bit about some of the history of this, and then also what are some of the things that can be done about it, and that's not an easy thing with the kind of abuses that we've heard about. In terms of the history, of course, keeping actually exercising free speech rights and dealing with government repression of free speech rights is an age-old problem. It goes back to the early days of our country. Certainly, we've studied the horrible repression of labor activists in the 1800s, in the 1920s, 30s. We all know about the Chicago Convention in 1968, et cetera, et cetera. So none of this on one level is new. But I think the kind of things that we were seeing in Denver and St. Paul come in part from our own WTO protests. And here's how I see that. What happened in WTO, as we all know, is there was overwhelming force used by the government, by the police, both against peaceful, nonviolent protesters who were engaged in civil disobedience, and against bystanders who had nothing to do with the protests. And so we all saw it in the progressive community as a tremendous violation of rights and an example of what we shouldn't do, and we've been trying to deal with that ever since. Well, the law enforcement community around the country drew a different lesson. Because WTO really gave Seattle a black eye in terms of public image, because we're viewed as such a laid-back, mellow place, and there were these images in the mass media of chaos and what was going on. And, the streets were not under the control of the government, and you saw all this tear gas and pepper spray. What was this all about? So other cities asked the Seattle police to give presentations in the wake of WTO as to how do you handle large-scale protests, really big protests. And the lesson that other cities got was that Seattle's response to WTO was too soft. And so what we've seen in anti-globalization protests after WTO in other cities, and now in political convention protests in 2004 and now 2008, because these are major examples of large-scale protests where police departments look back to the lessons of Seattle, is let's not let something like this happen again. So how do they prevent it? It's not a matter of let's respect people's civil liberties and rights to protest, and let's talk with people in advance who are in the protest community so we can make sure that we understand what they're doing and accommodate their legal rights. It's not that at all. It's just the opposite. So first of all, you see preemptive actions. We saw this in, 2002, where they went to a convergence center and just started arresting people or searching under fire codes, where they would close down the planning areas under bogus claims of fire codes, or sometimes they would actually get warrants and search based on trumped up notions of what people were preparing to do. So that's one, and you saw that replicated here. In other words, preemptive actions to shut down the protests before they ever happen. The second thing is when protests do take place, overwhelming police force is used. And again, you saw that in the video. In other words, Seattle was too soft initially. That was the idea. Ha, ha, ha. And instead, so if anybody is out in the street protesting, arrest them, ask questions later. So that's the second kind of thing you saw. A third thing that we've seen is for non-civil disobedience, but in other words, protesters that are not going to be breaking the law, Often they get permits in advance. So what happens is the government says, fine, we understand you want to protest, we support that right, but legally, and this is true, they have the right to control time, place, and manner reasonably. So they say what's reasonable far out of sight of the actual people you're protesting against. And these are known as protest zones. Sometimes they're even called protest pens, where it's very restricted. So yeah, you have the right to protest legally. It's just way far away from the people you're trying to protest against. And that also means the media, who's going to be at the site of the action, may not even see you, so that the protest happens but is ineffective. And then the last thing we're seeing, which is a definite escalation, is going right after the media preemptively. So if the media, if the alternative media at least, isn't there to cover it, the story's not going to get out. And I see a lot of this coming from what the law enforcement community took as the lessons of WTO. And this is going to be an increasingly difficult thing for the progressive community to deal with, because it's very hardball tactics. So in terms of what can be done about it, it's on two levels. You know, on one level, it's legal. So they have groups like the ACLU, the National Lawyers Guilds, and others trying to, as much as possible, file lawsuits to make sure that people's legal rights are respected. Now, how does that work in practice? If it's already around the time of the action, or during the action, like police have started to do things that appear to be illegal, that are restricting people's protest rights, you're not going to win those lawsuits. Even if you and I can say, well, this is blatantly unconstitutional, there are very few judges we've seen that in the course of an action are going to step in and tell the cops they can't do this. And that's usually done as, we want an injunction right now, the police are doing this, judge, make them stop it. Very few judges are going to do that. During the WTO, there was the notorious no protest zone. Sounds blatantly unconstitutional. People for a 20-block area couldn't pass out leaflets, wear buttons, or even talk within that area if they were going to be opposing the WTO. How is that constitutional? We filed a lawsuit trying to stop it. Judge said, no, go right ahead, to the police. And that's typical of what we've seen in other cities. So what happens is the lawsuits come after the fact, and they're in different ways. The initial focus has to be for people who are busted, to get them out of jail, to get charges dropped if they're trumped up, or if somebody has engaged in nonviolent civil disobedience and has broken the law and can be charged with something, that they're not charged unreasonably with a felony, which has very serious consequences, but that the charge actually matches whatever law they broke. So that's the first line that you'll see legal action. Then you'll see lawsuits filed against the police for brutality and violation of rights and whatnot. And you know, you can expect that there will be some of those, certainly in the wake of what the kind of stuff we were seeing in St. Paul. So what happened with those in Seattle, in the WTO? There were two major sets of lawsuits that affected a lot of people. One was by a group called Public Justice. They sued on behalf of well over 100 people who were unlawfully arrested. The basic unlawfulness of it, when you arrest somebody, if you're police, you have to be able to say, this person broke that law, I saw him doing it. What the police did is they just had a blanket form that they would just fill out for everybody without any actual proof that an individual had broken the law. And when that finally got to court, the court agreed that the city had been wrong, and damages of $1 million, which is rather significant, were awarded. And of course, that's why you're seeing this pre-protest indemnity of $10 million, I've been told, is that's a reaction to the kind of lawsuits that were won. So every time you win something, the powers that be look for strategies to counter it. Lawsuits like that can be very helpful because they can provide precedents that will deter wrong behavior in the future, and also they educate and publicize what happened. which gets to what I see as the most important part, which is, you know, in terms of how to deal with this, which is shaping public understanding of what has happened after the fact, as to what the injustice was, what the wrongdoing was, what was unconstitutional. The biggest problem we've seen in the wake of WTO, to use that example, has been what? It's been that the mass media and many people who were not there have bought into the notion that WTO was a riot. That means anything that happened was the fault of the protesters. And if you see video footage of police looking out of control, well, maybe they had to because this was quote unquote a riot. And every time, you know, I did the communications, every time I talk to the press, that's a point I make. You know, this was not a riot. If it was a riot, it was the police were out of control. And that's been an awfully hard battle to get through the heads of mainstream media and just average citizens who were not there and get scared when they see turmoil in the street. So part of what has to happen is to continue to support the independent media, groups like Pepper Spray, KBCS, because that's who is going to tell the truth. Also increasingly use new media tools, something that we have much more available compared to WTO, or things like Flickr and YouTube, so the real story can get up very quickly and people can send viral videos around to their friends who send it to their friends who send it to their relatives, getting the story out. And also, for people here, engage the mainstream media. Don't just talk to your friends. If KUOW or KIRO, Dave Ross Show, if they have a discussion of any issues related to this, you should be some of the people calling in so that we're part of the people telling the story. And I think that's the basic stuff I want to say. Oh, I did want to add one other thing. The work the ACLU did around WTO, if you've never seen it, we did a big report mainly to help shape understanding afterwards. It's called Out of Control, and it's up on our website, and it's our view of what happened during WTO. We also filed a lawsuit against the No Protest Zone, and it's instructive what happened with that lawsuit. It was done on behalf of seven people, including one person who was passing out flyers with the First Amendment on it and got those confiscated by the cops. Yeah, it gets pretty surreal. And another person was a credentialed delegate to the WTO who came out onto the street to talk to people about what was going on inside and immediately was arrested by police when he's just talking to people about what he's seen. Again, it's as surreal as some of the footage you saw. So what happened with that lawsuit, four people got money damages from the city, including the guy, the delegate who was arrested, who got about $65,000. But the courts did not have a problem with the no protest zone. They did not do what we wanted, which is to find the no protest zone unconstitutional in itself. Instead, what they said is it's okay unless it was enforced in a way that violated people's rights. Well, duh, that was the whole idea, to prevent people from talking, wearing buttons, passing out flyers. But this is the problem you can run into with courts. So use the courts, but rely on political organizing and telling the story and building the movement.
So now I'd like to open the floor to questions for our panelists or for general discussion. When I call on you, just go ahead and stand up. And then if you can, just speak up, because I don't think this cord goes all the way out. So I saw your hand up first. Please, go ahead.
First thing, Doug, how far up the court system did you take this, no protest thing? That's the first thing. The other thing is that, I was in the Independent Media Center, the night after they declared martial law, and I think you were too, Susan. You know that the cops tried to come in there, and I think Dan Merkel was there, and they sat over there talking to the cops for a good 15, 20 minutes before the cops went away. And so this is to you, Larry, how were you able to stop the cops from, getting into that bus? Because, what we saw later on, they didn't care when they got to Italy. obviously they don't care now because they have a $10 million insurance policy. The cops are, they don't care if they break the law. If they have an insurance policy, then how can you stop them from breaking the law?
So I think the first question was to Doug about how far up the courts the ACLU took.
Okay. Can you hear me with a mic? Yeah. In terms of the question, how far up to the courts did it go? It was a federal lawsuit. It went to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. That's the major appeals court, which is one step short from the U.S. Supreme Court. There was one good thing about the ruling, which they said that the Bill of Rights does apply even when there are tumultuous times, such as the popular view of what was going on in the streets. So that part was useful and can be, because the government was not even accepting that. So then you'd ask in a situation like this, how come we didn't appeal this to the U.S. Supreme Court? There's a term lawyers have of not making bad law. So can you imagine if that issue went up to the current U.S. Supreme Court, what kind of precedent we might set? And so we didn't want to go there.
And then, Larry, the question is, how were you able to get those police to not get on the bus?
I think, to some extent, we're still trying to figure that out. And it's true. They also raided the Indy Media Center in L.A. during the Democratic Convention and shut down Indy Media briefly. And then they were able to get back on and find other places. Some of it was that they couldn't keep that many cops there for that long, because the march was very large and getting larger. Some of it is that we got right in their faces and they didn't have a warrant. So what's your justification? Well, they really didn't have one. They hadn't really thought it out. It never occurred to these particular cops that there would be opposition. So they really didn't know what to do. They got kind of clueless. And
they were asking whether or not there were dead bodies on the bus.
And
the only thing on this bus is some water, some food, and some broadcast equipment, and that's all that's on
there. The other,
it was a combination between Larry yelling at them and me telling them, very calmly, there's nothing on this bus. You don't really have an excuse.
The other thing we did, these particular, and they were St. Paul police. The other thing we did is this bus was sitting in a parking lot about an eighth of a mile behind a place called the Black Dog Cafe that was having a benefit for Code Pink. So Karen went up and got Colonel Ann Wright and got a bunch of people from Code Pink, who then got the media out there, and we got our clients, whose bus it was, to come with video cameras and film the cops. And all of that finally was too much for them. And they left one cop, and the cop waited for us to leave, and we sat there forever until that last cop finally left. But it was a combination of yelling at them, the fact that they didn't know what the hell they were doing, explaining to them that they didn't know what they were doing, and getting a lot of people they really didn't want to deal with there. And they were outnumbered very quickly, which they didn't think they would be with eight cars. So we turned the balance on it over time.
I would just like to add that we were ready to get rated as independent media makers. And we, unfortunately, had to have a secure space that was not public, that nobody knew where it was. And that's how we were able to continue to produce our show. Because we knew that this was going to happen. And the indie media space that was public was basically the drop spot for the tapes that other people would bring in. And then an unnamed person
Thank you, and go ahead.
My name is W.C., and what's happened to the police state of America, and what the press? They're part of the government, they're in the same bed. I don't want to be in bed with my government, I don't want to be embedded.
All right, thank you. So from the back, in the center, go ahead. Go ahead, stand up, say it loud, say it proud. Okay, thank you. Does anyone have a, by the water. Go ahead. Oh, there's been a request for folks to either speak up louder or to come down here and address everyone this way. So whichever you're more comfortable with. But in the black, yes, go ahead, if you have a question or comment.
My name is Andrea, and I really want to thank everyone for being here and for Pepper Spray Productions for being down in St. Paul and at the DNC and for presenting this. I think it is really important that, we look at what's going on in all spheres of this society and around the world as well. I do a lot of work with the Revolutionary Communist Party. We have a paper of our own, and we've launched a series of initiatives looking very deeply into the history of the communist movement and summing up from that. Those are some of the most liberating experiences that humanity has had, and looking at, in a scientific way, what were the errors, what were the advances, and where do we go from here? I mean, we're living literally in a dictatorship. This is a country that from its very founding, it was founded on the genocide of Native Americans. It was founded on slavery. There have been, I just read this thing in Real Change, there have been 300 deaths from people being tased by police. The people are being killed right now. This is not, sometime in the future. This is happening now. And it's happening to people all over the world. I mean, you talk about the WTO and globalization. Literally, people around the world in third world countries are living off less than $2 a day. We need to start discussing again, like we did in the 60s and 70s, and despite the repression that they're raining down on us, we need to talk about what is it going to take? What does humanity really need? Start talking about revolution. Start talking about communism. Start talking about how, all of this can be radically... I'm not talking about Stalin, though. I'm talking about... I mean, I'm making very broad points here, and I don't necessarily have a question. I just think that, I really want to encourage people to dig into alternative media, including Revolution Newspaper. We're going to be having a discussion that I have flyers for on communism and Jeffersonian democracy. And it's really good to see everyone here, and thanks again.
So I'd like to thank everyone for their statements, and I'm wondering if anyone has a question. Let's go with questions for now. Yes, in the back right.
Thank you.
Uh-huh. Is anyone? Yes, Doug.
Okay. Yeah, that's actually a good point. The police are part of the City of Seattle government. Their bosses are the city council and the mayor, both of which are elected offices. I'm not Pollyannish about how easy it is to get them to do something, but ultimately the police work for us, and the voters, the public, through political pressure or whatever, can attempt to direct what they do. You know, one little example actually was the marijuana enforcement initiative, I-75, where the people of the City of Seattle says, okay, the cops work for us. We would like to direct them as our public servants to make enforcement of possession of marijuana their lowest priority. And in the wake of demonstrations after WTO, where there were problems with police behavior, you may recall there were some hearings at the city council where many activists showed up and reported what they had seen, and it gets covered by alternative media and mainstream media. So yeah, the answer is, yeah, pressure our elected officials to control police behavior. An interesting part of that point was, do people remember Ian Spears? He was the photography student at the Ballard Locks who was racially profiled when he set up for a student project. He sets up a tripod at the Ballard Locks and gets descended on by 9 law enforcement officers and wanting to know if he's a terrorist. Okay, we represented him in filing a complaint over that. So what happens? The local officials told us he's welcome to come back there, no problem, but that there was also Homeland Security people involved. We went to Homeland Security, we filed a complaint. Relating to your point, they're totally unaccountable to anybody. What they told us is that they would investigate, and if it were determined that their officials had acted wrongly, they would take care of it, but they would never notify Ian or anybody else about it, which is pretty amazing, but that's because they're utterly unaccountable to anybody in our community. So regardless of what complaints we may have about local police or King County sheriffs, at least there's some sort of accountability we can try to exert through our government, whereas Homeland Security, good luck.
Larry, you wanted to respond.
Yes, please. I think you bring up a couple of very, very important points. First of all, yeah, the militarization of police has gotten progressive. And by the way, the use of the military to do law enforcement, and the two are starting to overlap now that we have a brigade that's assigned to Northern Command to quell civil unrest. The two have been getting closer and closer to each other, and that's extremely scary. Prior to September 11th, there was a huge movement back 7 years ago against police brutality and against racial profiling and against in-custody deaths that had gotten quite large that just got completely squashed. And since then, every year, the Homeland Security has been pumping huge amounts of money into local cops to get new toys upon new toys upon new toys. And we have tasers and huge fire extinguisher size pepper spray and all kinds of less lethals that they did not have. And what we know about cops is when they get these toys, they use them, and people die. and that's been getting spiraling worse and worse. They pumped $50 million into Denver, $50 million into St. Paul to buy all kinds of new toys. And they used a lot of them. They're driving around Denver. You saw one shot of it hanging onto the sides of these armored personnel carriers at peaceful demonstrations. Now, the money is starting to dry up. Homeland Security is now saying they're going to put all these restrictions and require matching funds, so the toys are going to start dwindling, at least to some extent. And now we have a major budget crisis, which is actually a real opportunity to say, hold it, we have priorities, and this isn't them. And I think we have to do it, as Doug says, on a local level. We have to also do it on a national level. There's no indication that whether it's okay, I almost combine them, which is what I'm feeling about, Obama or McCain, it's going to make much difference. The spying is in place and is going to happen. The use of law enforcement and the military this way is going to happen. We have to stop this on a national level as well. What they have done in the world in bringing terror and being an occupying army in this endless list of countries is now coming home, and we have to stop it here. And we have to do that both here locally and everywhere. And we have to say, no, we will not tolerate this anywhere. We won't tolerate you doing it to the people of Iraq and Afghanistan and Pakistan and Colombia and so on. And we won't tolerate you doing it to the people of St. Paul and Denver and Seattle either. And that means a lot of both lobbying, and mostly it means a lot of good old-fashioned being out in the streets and demanding it, and having demonstrations and saying, we will not accept this. You will not do this in our name.
So. Thank you. And for those who live in Seattle, I believe Tim Burgess is the chair of the Public Safety and Human Services Committee, if you're into that stuff. So another question. Yes. Tactics that worked at the RNC and DNC, and feel free to define what it means to work, or what was positive or negative about the said tactic. Anyone? Did you in the orange? Go ahead. So I'm sorry to interrupt, but I'm wondering what tactic, what were you leafletting or talking? Sure, sure. There's many things you can do to relay education. Go ahead, Erica.
My question is, as activists, what are the current tactics that seem to be working in our
Larry, and then Larry, and then Larry.
Quickly, I think one thing is the blockades on Monday worked. They worked far better than the rest of us who were elsewhere in downtown or anywhere else knew. We didn't find out until afterwards how effective they were on Monday and how much that scared the cops. And that did set the tone for the rest of the week, and they got nastier and nastier, but it worked, and it showed that people had the ability to really mess with the convention. And that was extremely important. And I think that is a lesson that can be used again in different ways.
Yeah, stop the damn war now.